Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, autism is something we hear more and more about these days through TV shows like The Good Doctor and Parenthood, but it's still pretty mysterious to most people. I first heard the term in about 1980 in a book titled Sunrise, that's S-O-N, Rise, by a Navy researcher who I knew through my work at the time, and it was about his son. But although I'm familiar with the concept of autism spectrum disorder and Asperger's, I'm still not real clear about the way it manifests itself, and if we have any idea what causes it, and if there are ways to treat it. So my guest today is Melissa Reiner, a special education professional who's an expert on autism, and in fact is the autism consultant on the Good Doctor TV show. Melissa is considered one of the top autism and behavioral consultants by leading pediatric neurologists and developmental pediatricians in Southern California, from where she's joining us today. Welcome, Melissa.
Hi, thank you, Court.
Thanks for being on. Why don't we just plunge in and start with the basics? What is autism, and maybe describe the range of conditions and kind of their characteristic symptoms, if you would?
So autism is a diagnosis that usually occurs when we see, specifically, often it's diagnosed in a younger age, but it can be. I actually just received a call from a woman who said, I think I need help in diagnosing my husband. So, but typically we see in children that there are challenges with communication. There may be also evidence of rigidity issues where we sort of might say a child feels stuck. A child may also struggle with transition, moving from one activity to another, especially if it's what we call a non-preferred activity. Reading social cues is a big marker. And there are also often what we call perseverations, or what some people might call an obsessive focus. So a child may be focused a lot or perseverating over trains or buses or animals or numbers or planets. And it becomes pretty consuming. So what we see is what may initially look like an interest. And a lot of families say, we didn't think anything was different or challenging about our child. He just knew everything from every book he'd ever read. So we just assumed he was a genius, which he may be. But then we see all these other challenges where we may see meltdowns because we are transitioning, or we really are struggling in reading social cues in our social interactions, things like that.
So it sounds like one aspect of it is what's often called an obsessive-compulsive disorder, maybe. I mean, we mentioned the idea of the autism spectrum, and so that gives you the idea that it's maybe a continuum, but is it really a continuum where we're talking about degrees of autism, or are there certain kind of distinctive conditions that are along the autism kind of line that are different from each other and recognizable that aren't just a matter of degree from one to the other?
The markers that I stated are among some of the key markers that we look for in a diagnosis, and I am not a diagnostician, but I think when we talk about the spectrum, the more prevalent autism becomes, the more I hear people saying, I might be a little bit on the spectrum. I have some of those issues. I have trouble transitioning, or you know, we see a little bit of ourselves. And I think that's part of the spectrum where I can work with 50 different kids, all diagnosed with ASD, and they are 50 unique individuals. There is a broad range. And each child, each individual with a diagnosis is really unique because we are all unique individuals. But so it may present very differently. And I work with one child who is really quite affectionate, which is often a deficit that we may see with a diagnosis of autism. But he's really loving with his brother, his parents. He writes about them, talks about them, and not in an obsessive way, in a really natural and genuine way. So that would be something that you typically wouldn't see with a child with a diagnosis. But yet, he possesses this wonderful attribute to really connect in with his family in a, like I said, in a really wonderful way. That's, I think, what we're seeing, that there's not a cookie-cutter definition. This means that, you know, when someone is diagnosed with any kind of disorder, I think there's typically a range. And for example, another child I work with, his parents are in the throes of a divorce. And so it really augments his presentation of symptoms. He may appear to have a much more pronounced and profound experience with these challenges. And I think it's augmented by his emotional, you know, sort of experience that's going on at home. So that's why we say there's a spectrum, because you can have some aspects and not others. And then with girls, the diagnosis is, I think, really challenging. And we see that there are very different presentations for girls and for boys. So where we see that the statistics show that there are many more boys being diagnosed, we're finding now because the way in which we diagnose, the symptoms we're looking for, are really presenting very differently for females.
I didn't realize it was so ambiguous and with such diverse kind of presentations. I thought there were kind of a few different, clear characteristics, but it's obvious that it's can be a pretty vague thing. I mean, are people, from what you can tell or what we know, are people born with it? If not, at what age does it become, or maybe if so, even at what age does it become apparent typically?
Yeah, it can be slightly elusive. Like I said, there was a woman who contacted me and said, I have suspicions about my husband. But here's a 35-year-old man who's lived his life, is married, right? Things that we find typically parents are concerned about with their children. Will they grow up? Will they have a successful career, a marriage that's, fulfilling? And here, this man has that, and we're still seeing challenges that have gone undiagnosed. Typically, we see these challenges emerge at a much earlier age. Again, it depends on the degree and the severity with which we see these present. So some kids are more profoundly impacted by autism. It would appear that this child may have been born with this diagnosis and that they are really challenged to communicate. They may be what's called apraxic. They may really have difficulty even speaking in the most basic terms. And we may see also developmental delays very early on, that they're just not meeting these sort of developmental milestones. And I even worked with basically a newborn who was about 6 weeks old. He wasn't meeting these sort of basic milestones of eye contact. Around 6 weeks, we see a child smile typically. We see them gaze, in particular with their mother, but typically even with a sibling or another parent and other individuals, and we weren't seeing this. And this was a woman I knew very well, so she knows what I do for a living. She said, "Can you please look at my son?" Mm-hmm. And we got to work, and we sort of implemented some techniques that helped him to then connect in where he really wasn't. It appears as though we've really remediated, and now he's 8. There wasn't a diagnosis, mm-hmm. but we were really seeing these developmental delays sort of as being a parent at the age of 6 weeks. Again, I don't diagnose, but I've seen the whole gamut from birth till I work with another man who's 48 years old. He has a job and he lives independently, cooks for himself, drives himself to work, is always on time. Just wonderful man, very sweet and kind, but has these other challenges.
I had to laugh at your story about the husband because I suspect there's a fair percentage of wives who would wonder if their husbands were autistic in terms of communication. Anyway, but so, you were talking about, even it sounds like the diagnosis is kind of amorphous sometimes, right? So who does typically diagnose autism? Is it a pediatrician or more a specialist like you? Or, just quickly, kind of what categories of people are qualified to actually make a definitive diagnosis like that rather than just saying, well, it may be this or it might be that,
Yeah, often the families I work with, I don't diagnose, but most of the families I work with, I'll say, when did you sort of start sensing that there were some challenges? And they said, it was our preschool director, or the head of the preschool said, maybe you should get him assessed. So sometimes moms will say, and dads will say, I really just wanted to find out if there was anything going on. So sometimes it's from parents. Sometimes the impetus comes from a caregiver or a friend or at school, at preschool with the director or teacher. But when we go to have an assessment, we typically meet with a pediatric neurologist or developmental pediatrician. I live in the Los Angeles area, and there are plenty of developmental pediatricians, but in the rest of the nation, they're few and far between. So it may sometimes be a pediatrician who is not a developmental pediatrician who may notice, it doesn't look like we're meeting these milestones. Which also, I wanted to preface that I don't want parents to fly into a panic and think, oh my gosh, my son isn't clapping, and he's supposed to clap at 9 months or 6 months, and he's not. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there's stages, not ages. So sometimes we see our children not necessarily meeting certain milestones, and it does not necessarily mean that alarm bells need to ring and we need to worry that our children have a diagnosis of one thing or another. So I want parents to sort of breathe, because it's really easy to go into a crisis mode for parents. And I don't know if that's beneficial in the long run. So we want to really take into account the whole picture. I'll have families who come to me and say, what do you think? And again, I don't diagnose, but I'll say, you know, I'm really seeing your child connect beautifully with me or with his peer group or with family. And there are these other challenges. He may have sensory issues. He may have a speech delay, but it doesn't necessarily mean, mm-hmm. right? It's not causal, right? So it may not necessarily mean that he has autism. So we have to be careful. I want parents to slow down and really take every piece of the puzzle and see what that looks like.
Yeah, I was thinking that too. I mean, compared to 50 or more years ago, parents today are so hyper and so super focused, mm-hmm. and they're so over-informed in a sense by the internet and by their peer parents, mm-hmm. and that kind of thing. And, you know, for example, I did a show, I don't know, years ago on attention deficit disorder, and, you know, so many kids, you know, boys in particular, who were just acting like boys were being diagnosed with ADD,
right.
and medicated at, you know, the age of 3, and, you know, come on, you know, that kind of thing. So it's possible, I think, that there are people who freak out, as you say, when some milestone that they've read about isn't met that week or whatever, and, you know, and...
Right.
Anyway, but let's talk about those kids and those people who do have, who do fall on the spectrum somewhere, and in particular, maybe Asperger's.
The new trend now is that we're not diagnosing individuals with Asperger's anymore. And sometimes they'll say, what about the thousands of people who have to diagnose? Typically, it's just diagnosed as ASD, so the autism spectrum disorder, and then, like we were saying, the varying degrees therein.
What would such a person seem like to the rest of us who are not yet diagnosed with Asperger's, to normal people?
Yeah, when there was still a diagnosis, it was sort of my specialty. I felt really comfortable working with individuals too. And I didn't make this up, and I don't know who said it, so forgive me, and I'm paraphrasing when I say, when we say an individual is high functioning, we may be overlooking their deficits. And when we say someone is low functioning, we may be overlooking their assets.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really important, because when we say someone is high functioning, we say, you know, phew, great, wonderful. They really look like they're attending in school, and they're not violent, and they're not aggressive, and they're really sweet, really intelligent, and look at them, and they're doing great. But these individuals often slip through the crack, because there are so many nuances that can easily be overlooked, especially if our children appear to be attending. Just because my child is sitting and facing front and not causing a problem, for any child on or off the spectrum, frankly, doesn't mean that they're really gleaning information, that they're growing and learning as an individual. I try to be so mindful of being aware of, just because someone appears to be what we would call high functioning. And I worked with an individual who most people would say looks like he's moderately to low functioning. Within the autism spectrum, and he was so eager to share my attention, and he was so eager to join with me in an activity, which is really important, and that's foundational for friendships and for, you know, thriving relationships in work, at home. And he was this amazing kid, but in other areas, he looked like he was more challenged.
Hmm.
But really, he was doing great. So we have, you know, don't judge a book by its cover. So we really look at each individual as an individual. To answer your question, I think we may really see that someone may be super bright,
mm-hmm.
but they have no ability to, you know, their IQ may be off the charts, but they're really challenged in how to communicate effectively with a peer or with anyone that they're engaged with in any kind of social interaction. It can be harmful, because we say, wow, look at how great they're doing. They don't have any trouble at school. They're getting straight A's, whatever it is. But socially and emotionally, they're really unfulfilled.
A couple things occur to me. I mean, a few years back, I was at a party that some friends had put on, and there the brother of one of the couple was at the party, and I talked with him, a middle-aged man, and I noticed right away he was talking too loudly. It was like, you know, half again as loudly as he should talk. And in trying to have a conversation with him, he would not respond back and forth, you know, in a, you know, hit the tennis ball across the net and hit it back across the net. But not that kind of way. It was kind of like all one-sided. And I quickly sort of pulled away, like, what's with that guy? And then I kind of later edged into the conversation with the woman of the couple who was my friend, and she said, well, he has Asperger's syndrome. And I wasn't sure if that was the only way that it manifested itself or not. I guess it's just one way. But I mean, I'm thinking what's weird is that the term autism was unknown to the public in general until, I guess, around 1980 or the early 90s. And I wonder, was it recognized but not diagnosed, or was it diagnosed as something else, or did it really not exist as prevalently? I mean, was it just called retardation or just being weird, or, you know, terms like that that were sort of vague and generic back then, do you know?
Yeah, so there are several points. So I think the diagnosis where we see developmental delays with, you know, when you say retardation, we're really looking at markers for IQ levels and what we call adaptive living skills. And it also has to be, I think, a diagnosis before the age of 18 to be considered that. But I think that there are some individuals with autism who may have lower IQs and may have challenges with adaptive living skills. So there is probably, you know, if you're looking at a Venn diagram, there's an overlap for sure. But the two diagnoses are distinct and different from one another. And I think that, you know, many, many years ago, in order to receive a diagnosis of autism, it had to be pretty severe and pretty profound. And I think once people became more aware and informed, this really does qualify as a diagnosis, even though this child, maybe if you, you know, looked at first blush, you wouldn't guess. Just like the man in the story, the brother in the story that you just told, you walked up to him and started a conversation. There was nothing that looked different. Mm-hmm. It was only that sort of volume, and the reciprocal conversation was missing. And I think what we're also finding as we become more informed about a diagnosis and the increase in diagnoses, when the spectrum sort of opens up to increase the number of diagnoses, and from my perspective, then we start also seeing more and more ways where we might work to remediate some of these challenges. From my perspective, in the work I do, if I'm working with an individual, a child or an adult, who has challenges with modulating their volume or awareness of the volume level around them, I simply spotlight that for them. Mm-hmm. I help develop and cultivate that awareness for them. When we discover something, we build neuronal pathways in the brain. The difference, I've used this example before, but I think that when we follow those navigation systems on our phones or in the car, and you get to where you were hoping to get, you arrive at your destination, but sometimes you don't really have the awareness of how you got there. You weren't paying attention in the same way as if you were creating your own map. Okay, you turn left here, three stoplights up, I'm going to turn right, then it's the fourth house on the left. That gets integrated differently than if we're sort of following directions. So if someone is always told, lower your volume, I don't know if we've developed the awareness that our volume is not being modulated, or, you know, that we have the awareness of how others, you know, are utilizing their volume levels. When instead of saying to someone, you know, stop doing this or please do that, which is a command, and we start speaking in a way that affords an individual an opportunity to discover for themselves, oh, I'm really noticing that everyone is really talking at a lower volume. Does this register? Does this sink in? Does this help cultivate that awareness? Most of the time it does. And if I say, so I hear that you're speaking really loudly, does that help to lower and modulate their volume to a more appropriate level? It's different than telling someone to do it. I worked with a child who didn't know the difference between please, sorry, thank you, and you're welcome. Had no clue what each of those meant because they were always told, say please, say thank you, say you're welcome. So they just said it. Mm-hmm. And half the time there was, you know, percentage of the time they could probably guess, I'm going to say this and hope that lands. Someone hands you something. You're welcome. Oh, no, that was a thank you. You know, so we, you know, 50% of the time we might get it right.
interesting. Another example from my end and my limited exposure. I'm acquainted with someone who's the director of a major research center at a university. Mm. It's medically related, and it's a very successful center. But that person has always been a little strange, and he dominates conversations to an unusual degree, and you know, and often that's characteristic of doctors, let's say. But in this case, it was odd. So at a certain point, he was diagnosed as having Asperger's syndrome, and so. Mm-hmm. And so people, I don't know exactly in detail how it was done, but people around him all basically developed a strategy or a process in a way for trying to kind of shepherd him toward more acceptable interactions in a way. I mean, he was brilliant at what he did. You were talking about high-functioning people, and so he had no idea there was anything wrong, but you could kind of tell, and especially if you're in a long interaction with a person, you could very much tell. So over time, in my contacts occasionally with this person, I see that he's changed. So, you know, again, a highly intelligent person, so he does pick up and has been probably told, although you're saying that the direct assertion, you talk too loud, is not that effective, but in whatever ways it was approached, he's learned to moderate what seemed to him to be normal behavior, to warp it into mm-hmm. what seems to him to be abnormal behavior, but that everybody else shares, I guess is the way you'd put it. So he's become less clearly Asperger-y in that sense, but I'm wondering, I mean, you were talking about something that I saw in looking, in reading about you a little bit that you call a shift in communication style. And so it's, I gather getting away from a tendency toward commands and questions and into a more declarative form of communication like you were describing. And so apparently that seems to be something that people on the autism spectrum can deal with less stress and more productively, that form of communication than being told what to do or being asked direct, blunt questions about what they do. And
when most adults, teachers, parents, most every adult speaks to most children, most of the time using imperatives and interrogatives. Almost everything's a command and everything's a question to a really high degree. That's how interaction flows. So it's a command, come to the table. Did you brush your teeth at school? Get your pencil. Why aren't you in line, right? Well, what we find is that when we are speaking to individuals with typically using commands and questions, we see a spike in heart rate and blood pressure from the recipient. And that is pretty tantamount to an anxiety response. And when instead we speak declaratively, which I always tell families we're using I statements, we really find that it does not spike that same level of you know, that same spike in heart rate and blood pressure we don't see when we're simply having a conversation that's almost like thinking out loud, sharing your thoughts. I don't need my child to give me the right answer necessarily. What's that up in the sky? That's the what is it? That's the I don't need them to say moon. I'm prompting them to give me the right answer. That's not really a meaningful interaction. So I can sit all day in front of a child and say, what color is this? What is this child doing? Where is that located? And so they may give me a million right answers. That won't help us engage socially because one is a rote skill. Mm-hmm. That color that's red is always going to be red. It will always, it's a rote, discrete skill.
Yeah.
To identify colors and say the right answers. That's the boon. And when we speak with others in social interactions, it is entirely dynamic. It's unpredictable, it's nuanced, it's subtle, it's ever-changing. And just like you started talking to that man at the party and then uncovered, in short order, that there were some challenges in the interaction, right? It's always changing, it's always unpredictable. So if we teach how to interact in a rote way using discrete mechanisms, then we're never going to know how to interact in meaningful, genuine, natural ways. And I'm always mindful to use using the word normal, because we're all normal, even if we have challenges. But there are sometimes, like we said, developmental delays. It doesn't mean that a person isn't normal. It just means they're challenged with these things. So I always try to be careful of that. But when instead we're really learning how to dynamically interact with one another. For example, I mean, that's the crux of this work. So, for example, if I show a child a picture of a smiley face, and I say, that's someone who's happy. And I show a child a picture of a sad face with a tear running down and an upside-down smile, that's someone who's sad. then we miss the nuance. When someone goes to shake our hand and they're smiling, but you can tell there's pain or sadness, or maybe they're depressed, or maybe they're angry. But there's a smile plastered right on their face, right? I've shaken people's hands, and they're like, nice to meet you, but they don't mean it, you know? And so I would miss that social cue. I just assume they're really happy. There's a smile, but I'd miss the nuance, the subtlety, the real underlying emotion that's really what's happening. And the same with tears. I was with my girlfriend when she had her baby. And I have three kids of my own, but watching someone give birth is pretty remarkable. And I wept. I was sobbing. And so someone would look at me who assumed that I learned that when I see a tear, that someone is really sad.
Hmm.
And so if someone's patting my shoulder and saying it'll be okay, they're missing the gist. They're missing the social interaction that's so important, which is I'm elated. My friend had this beautiful, healthy baby. That's what's so compelling.
Melissa, we just have a minute or so left, but I mentioned at the outset that you're a consultant on the TV show The Good Doctor, in which the main doctor is autistic in some way. And so I wish we had time for us to talk about your role in doing that. But I guess the basic question is, do you think that with that increase in visibility of this condition and its various kind of presentations, do you think that there's an increase in understanding and acceptance in the general public and maybe a lessening of the stigma of being told someone is autistic?
I hope so. And I think what's unique about this show, and I'm able to work with the actors and the writers and the producers, and it's wonderful because they're really, really invested in making sure that this is an authentic portrayal of this individual. And what's amazing is I feel like on so many other shows, we've seen how autism is dealt with in a really more of a familial scope. And here, it's pretty unique because in The Good Doctor, there's distinctly no family directly involved. And this is all peer group interactions. These are all work-related interactions for the most part. And, you know, people living in the apartment complex with him and those interactions, people out in the world. And it's not just about how we handle it in the, you know, on the micro level, it's really extending it to the macro. And we're seeing as the prevalence, you know, of diagnoses is what it is, which is pretty profound. You know, we're seeing that now all these kids with diagnoses 20 years ago are growing up and they are out in the world. And we are seeing that there are interactions in the workforce and in business and in all these social arenas that before were really, it was sort of a private thing, and now it's really public, and I like that.
Well, that's good, and I think that people like you have had an impact on that, and these shows certainly do too. But Melissa, we are out of time, and we're going to have to leave it there. If you want to learn more about this subject, and there's a lot to learn, you can go to Melissa's website at bridgingpathways.com or also askmelissanow.com, askmelissanow.com. Melissa Reiner, thank you so much for being on with us and talking about autism today.
Cord, thank you so much for having me on.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.